I'm Dr. Vanessa Sinclair, an artist and psychoanalyst based in Sweden who works with people internationally. And this is episode 292 of Rendering Unconscious Podcast. My guests today are Drs. Emma Lieber and Anna Fujian. They're here to talk about their book, The Queerness of Childhood, Essays from the Other Side of the Looking Glass. I'm also happy to announce that the new edition of Rendering Unconscious the Book, Rendering Unconscious Psychoanalytic Perspectives, is now available from Chapar Books. It's available at Amazon and wherever you love to get your books online. This collection was originally published in 2019 and it sold out pretty quickly. And so we've now collected the papers together into a new expanded edition, which expanded so much that it went from being one book to two. So now it's two books, Rendering Unconscious Psychoanalytic Perspectives, Volumes 1 and 2, now available. It's a collection that I edited. It's near and dear to my heart. Emma Lieber, for example, is included in the collection. She actually has a piece in each of the volumes of the book, and they are fantastic. And there's a lot of people from Das Unbehagen since the collection was put together between the years of 2017 and 2018. It came out in early 2019. There's a lot of people from Das Unbehagen, including David Lichtenstein, Jameson Webster, many, many others. And we also have new additions like Hilda Fernandez Alvarez, S. Alfonso Williams, Dwight Turner, and lots of poetry. Both collections are dedicated to my dear friend Andrew Dahl, who passed away far too young, about a year and a half ago. And his poetry has been collected by our dear friend Peter, whose poetry is also included in the collection. And so I'm happy to be able to publish as much of Andrew's poetry as possible. Another dear friend of ours, Aaron, wrote a beautiful poem for Andrew that is the final piece in the book in volume 2. So it rounds out the collection. There's a lot of other wonderful poets, Tom Bland, who you've heard on the podcast before, Amy Gaeta, who you've heard on the podcast before, and pieces also in the collection by a lot of other Rendering Unconscious guests that I've had over the years, including Damian Patrick Williams, Craig Slee, and so, so many others. I've just published a newsletter listing everybody who's in the book and different topics that have been written about. So if you want to keep up to date with those newsletters, join me at patreon.com/renderingunconscious or subscribe to my Substack, which is renderingunconscious.substack.com. So thanks, and I'll see you there. Please follow Anna and Emma's work. I have links to their works. I've had Emma on the podcast before, as well as we did a book launch for her book, The Writing Cure, a couple of years ago. So I'll link to those episodes of Rendering Unconscious podcast in the show notes, as well as at renderingunconscious.org. And of course, you can follow them there and stay abreast of their work. Enjoy. Hi, Anna and Emma. I'm so glad that we are here together for Rendering Unconscious.
Hi.
Hi, Vanessa. Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I'm so excited to hear all about your book and everything you all are up to. I miss you all.
We miss you too. It's been a long time.
Yeah. How's New York been?
Glad to see you.
Great. New York misses you. I can't wait for you to come back. Give a talk. Hang
yeah,
out.
It's going to be fun. I know. I can't wait to see everybody. It's been 6 years. It's wild. So what have you been up to? Tell me what you're working on.
Oh boy. well, I have a book manuscript that is in process. So, and it's a bit of, what should I call it? It's kind of an experimental cancer memoir that is also theoretical and also about childhood in a way. It's about the late Soviet period. It's very nonlinear, leitmotivic, and it's wild. I'm just in the process of editing it. So that's what's on the desk right now.
Oh, I love this already. I can't wait to read it. I just put out my own book that's kind of like memoiric, but it's a novel, it's fiction. And it's definitely very much in this kind of free associative style. It's like one thing leads to the next and to the next. It's not linear either. So I'm so excited to read what you've written.
Right. And this is actually relates back to, I think, Emma's work and also our book, because it's queer narrative in a way, or you could call it that. Because it's the temporality of it is again nonlinear, but also it's in a way it functions like the analytic session does. And the mode of reading it requires is one in which you have to kind of wait and wait and hope that there'll be an après-coup motion, a retroactive sort of, clarification of things that might not totally seem understandable. You have to kind of delay ratification in this sort of work, at least in my view. What do you think, Emma?
Well, I found that was the case also in writing, in my first book, I don't know if you had a similar experience, Anna, but to try to write psychoanalytically was very much to subject yourself to that procedure, where writing also is a kind of waiting for the après-coup, where you don't know what the book will be until it will have been written. And then it will have been different from what you expected it to be when you started out.
Right, which drives editors crazy, because they're saying you have to flag all this stuff in your introduction. Right.
You can't flag. There's no flagging. But you also can't flag, because that gives the reader, that sets something up for the reader that's counter to what the procedure is supposed to be precisely.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to allow the reader to have that experience.
I'm so glad that I'm with like-minded people today.
Isn't it refreshing?
I know. Did you find that too in your book, the one you're working on? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it just came out a couple of weeks ago. And you know, I started mine like in 2020, like during the pandemic. So the height of the pandemic, I should say. And yeah, it was just like such a process, processing everything. And like one of my good friends from childhood was killed. And I was like processing that. And then that brought up all these memories from like, you know, our youth and teenage years. And so I was processing that. And then, of course, because we're psychoanalysts, like the theory keeps popping up, you know, like it all just keeps like tying together. And it's totally like a cathartic process and a working through. And yeah, it feels kind of weird that it's out there and that people can look at it, because it's kind of like my insides are now outside and now people can like read them. And I'm like, but that's supposed to be inside, but like it couldn't be inside anymore. It had to come out. So
right.
It is a bit scary. In fact, even just now telling you, I didn't expect you to start with that question. And I had to a little bit force myself to answer it, to be honest. But I did it. Yeah. But it'll all be on the outside soon enough. So, yeah.
Yeah, we're glad you did. And that's why I start that way. But let's talk about your book that you two wrote together, because, I want to hear all about it. And that's why we originally got in touch last summer when we were going to do the podcast. And now we're finally here.
Well, it's an edited collection called The Queerness of Childhood: Essays from the Other Side of the Looking Glass. And it brings together psychoanalysts and queer theorists around the figure of the child. Anna, you can say more about the history of the formation of the book, because it actually the book kind of originated before I was on the project. But most broadly, it seemed to us that it's time to sort of return queer theory and psychoanalysis to each other, like at this moment. I think there's something interesting to think through, actually, about why psychoanalysis and queer theory have historically needed each other, and maybe what in what way they might meet each other now, or sort of re-encounter each other in a new way. And it seemed to us that it was around the question of the child and sort of the polymorphousness of the child's body and sexuality that could mm-hmm. could happen most fruitfully. So that's kind of the broadest thing. Yeah.
And childhood as well, right? Childhood as a kind of queer time that is only constructed really retroactively, because the child is not in a position to construct its own childhood, as it were. So, yeah, in fact, the book began as a conference, as they often do. Before I knew Emma, it was in 2013. And it was a radical thing then to, I was teaching at Williams College, and it was a radical thing to invite analysts to Williams. People were like, who are these psychoanalysts that are going to, I mean, I think now it's more common, or maybe I'm just more in this kind of milieu where it happens all the time. But at the time, they didn't end up contributing to the volume, actually, but Avgi Sakatapulu was there at the conference, and Michael O'Loughlin. They were the only analyst. I was not an analyst at the time. So at any rate, yeah, I got interested in it in this topic initially because of my interest in queer time. I was studying, actually, of all things, the late Soviet period. And I noticed that there was a preoccupation with time and temporality in cartoons, which were very, very popular at the time, animation, animated film. And so I started to read Jack Halberstam on queer time. And I thought, wow, this is really, and I like this definition, his definition in particular of queer temporality, because it has to do with, at least as it was initially conceived in like 2010 or whenever it was this like response to the AIDS epidemic. And this diminishing horizon or diminishing future that fostered an approach to time and an experience of time that was more elastic and more about expanding the present. And this was kind of linked to queer embodiment and queer spaces. So these two worlds converged, and obviously animation is for both adults and children. Often. So, yeah, I went from there. But immediately or very soon after I started reading queer theory, I noticed that queer theory had a lot of queer theorists had kind of abandoned psychoanalysis or were arguing against it, thinking it was too normative. Everything that it's not my psychoanalysis, but the psychoanalysis that was being confronted was this kind of a normative developmental linear version. And in fact, I thought, well, queer time is the temporality of psychoanalysis, as I understand it, which is the après coup, the deferred action, the session as being kind of expanding outward and traversing past and present. So anyway, all to say that it felt to me, at least in the moment, that while psychoanalysis and queer theory were diverging, or queer theory felt sort of embattled with it, in fact, they were, in my mind, just could teach each other a lot and return psychoanalysis to the three essays that it's the non-normative part of the three essays, to name one paper that's a seminal paper. I don't know. Would you say, Emma, that now it's a little bit more integrated, or that like convergence has happened more, or they've refound each other, or no?
Well, I think it's a question of what kind of psychoanalysis is emerging now, you know, and it seems to me that a kind of queer psychoanalysis, which is itself a tautology, which is, I think, part of what you're saying, except that psychoanalysis has, you know, at certain times in its history, you know, maybe in certain places, certainly, you know, in the United States at various times, forgotten its sort of queer origins, or forgotten its kind of anti-normative force. And it's not, you know, it's not untrue. It's not as though the queer theorists are reading wrong. They are reading something correctly, some sort of normative, you know, line in psychoanalytic thinking that does originate in Freud. you know, and that others have picked up in various ways, and a conservatism in the discipline itself. I mean, that's sort of, you know, that you can't argue with that. But, you know, I'm particularly interested at the moment in, you know, there are all these sort of like article, like journal articles and, you know, stuff in the New York Times and in the Chronicle of Higher Education and the New Yorker, that are kind of like proclaiming that, at least in the United States, like psychoanalysis is back in this funny way, that it's starting to become part of popular discourse again. Not necessarily that more people are in analysis, that not hasn't
from necessarily my perspective, been- it's totally true. but also like I think a lot of our friends are publishing these articles, so we have to be careful.
That may be the case.
No, I'm kidding. But okay, yeah.
You have to start somewhere. So. But you know, and the notion being that, like, sort of among younger, you know, the younger Gen Z, like younger generations of sort of artists and podcasters and filmmakers, that there's like a kind of a return to Freud in a funny way, or to psychoanalysis as a theory. But that these, you know, these are younger generations that have, you know, very different politics and, you know, and are steeped in the kind of queer theory and trans discourse that has been coming out for decades. You know, and that's the place at which they're approaching psychoanalysis. So something, I mean, that I think is extremely promising for the field at the moment, and is something that, like, the old guard of psychoanalysis, I think, really has to, like really encounter and think very hard about.
Oh, can I just say one more thing, too, about the book specifically, that at some point, Emma kind of came on board. I met Emma and it was like sparks flew. And so she joined this volume. And it was great because I think what the volume really gained, not only did we, by then we were in training, in psychoanalytic training, and so we got more analysts to contribute to the volume, but also I think, Emma, you brought this interest in queer memoir, or this kind of nonlinear, you know, auto-theoretical, I don't know what you want to call it at this point, but, you know, which of course raised the question. And then we have a few contributions, including Emma's, to the volume that write in this way about childhood or about children. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, or I guess it raised for me these questions about what it means to write in a queer way. You know, what does it mean to queer something now? And, you know, we could say, well, it's a psychoanalytic kind of writing, because it punctuates in places you wouldn't normally punctuate. It's not, you know, it has retroactive effects, et cetera. But I don't know. I think you could also conceptualize it as a queer writing and go just as easily. So maybe that's a tautological claim again, but this is what the volume, I guess, wanted to raise.
I think so, you know, and I wonder how to square these various, like, sort of frames of thinking about it, but mm-hmm. you know, and I'm loath to define what queering is or what queer is, but, you know, the notion that it's something against it's something about reading against a grain, you know, sort of reading a text against itself, the way that sexuality is always kind of in a conflict, but that it's also, it seems to me, it's something about transference, and that it is, that's like, and this is what I found, you know, sort of found so compelling about certain aspects of queer theory, and, you know, found a really, you know, an important and interesting link with psychoanalysis, that these were texts often in queer theory that not only made sort of the body of the author somehow central, like that it was a kind of embodied form of writing, but that they recognized the transferential aspects of reading and writing, that these were texts that were very clear that they were aiming at an effect in the reader, which obviously, like any text, is that, you know, that's the aim of any text, and that's always what's happening with reading and writing. Right. But that was
more explicit. Like,
explicit. Mm-hmm. And that's something of the performative aspect of the practice of theory creation was being avowed. And that's something that psychoanalysis at its best does, right? It's a, that's what we know, is that speech is performative. And that what's at stake is the like transferential scenery of the act of articulation as much as whatever is being said, if not more so. But it seems to me that that's what psychoanalytic transmission and psychoanalytic writing has to remember and like too often sort of strays away from.
I was just going to say that it requires a certain mode of reading as well, right?
Right.
I like that point very much. Yeah. It kind of demands it in its performative nature. It makes it explicit, right, as you said, right? Very good. Yeah.
I love it. I love that this book kind of unfolded over 10 years from like the conference that you had all the way until it was published. So who ended up contributing to the book and what kinds of things did they write about? I love that it's centered around the child and childhood as well. It's so important.
Well, the first part was, my God, I'm getting the book now. There was one thing that fell away, which I wanted to do, which was like legal stuff around the child and consent, but that kind of disappeared. But we could, I would love somebody to write that book. That still hasn't maybe been done enough. So the first part is around development. It's called Queer Pasts. The book is divided into several parts, obviously in four parts. The first is called Queer Pasts, Origins, Development, and Normativity. And I think this is the section that has the most biographical and also historical aspects of childhood, including Emma's wonderful chapter and also Carrie Moore, who is one of our community, as well as a historian, Alison Miller, who writes about a correspondence in interwar United States between an older queer woman and her... And a younger kind of, it's kind of initiative, and as she becomes a kind of initiate in queerness, as it were. And Kevin Ohi, is he still at Boston College? Anyway, he's an academic who just did a queer reading of a text of Eudora Welty. So,
literature, which I think is important also to underline that there was literature as well in a lot of the essays.
But I don't know. Maybe Emma, you can say something about what links these together in your section.
I mean, I think it's something about living a life as text and sort of the history as text and the temporality of that. I mean, I thought, you know, Kevin's paper was really interesting because it's a reading of a literary text, and it's looking at the sort of the temporality of the text, you know, as a way of saying something about queer theory more broadly. And that was an interesting, you know, and something that I found interesting throughout the book is the different discourses that were being woven together in a lot of the essays. There was literature, there was anthropology, there's historical, you know, just that a lot of the several, something that connected several of the essays was that they were trying to say something very rigorous about the extent to which a kind of normative method of thought, let's say, is not, one doesn't want to think of it as necessarily opposed to anti-normativity, let's say, or whatever the emergence of the queer is, that they actually exist in dialectical relation with each other. And in one way or another, actually, a lot of the essays seem to center on that sort of conceptual maneuver.
Right. And then the second part is also has an anthropologist, analyst anthropologist, Victoria Malkin, Daniel Poliak, and Jules Gill Peterson. And it's really, the title of the part of that section really sums it up. Born This Way? Science, Mythology, and Psychoanalysis. And for me, I think, you know, it asks fundamental questions like, what is a baby? And what is the environment, in scare quotes, you know, this kind of Winnicottian environment? What is sexual difference? What is sex? And how does that get politicized and so and taken up in the consulting room and in the academy and also in the lab in the laboratory in by science. So I think it's a very kind of ambitious project there. I'm not sure I can summarize it fully, but or
yeah, I mean, but that in itself is super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And you could touch upon all those areas.
I'll say also, you know, just to say that Victoria Malkin's paper in particular, I think did something that at its best, like psychoanalysis does at its best, and, you know, maybe queer theory as well, or in a certain sense, which is that she was reading how babies are constructed by different discourses in different times and places, like how the baby is a discursive site historically and geographically, looking at how the baby is constructed. She was looking at African Beng tribes. She was looking at her own child and how the United States has, you know, and the sort of like industrial and capitalist discourses of the United States has constructed the baby, and also in other discourses. But what she also did in that paper, which I found like so important and ethical, is she also talked away about the ways in which both psychoanalysis and queer theory themselves construct the baby. So she kind of subjected the theory itself with which she was working to the very procedure which that theory demands. And that, I think,
which psychoanalysis does to itself, right?
Which psychoanalysis does to itself. I mean, that's quintessentially what psychoanalysis does. And that's where whatever is radical about psychoanalysis, I think, makes its presence felt. And I think that's like the maneuver that's too frequently forgotten. And I think it's that was what was very exciting to me, I think, about this book, is that there were moments at which something like that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a kind of, I mean, okay, I'm in my past life, I'm a historian. So, but there was something relentlessly historicist about her, her paper, her the chapter, but also I think really quite new, at least as far as I know, maybe in anthropology, this is parts of this has been done, but this sort of comparative, like what is a baby essay? I mean, I've seen this about childhood and how the child was conceived, but the baby in particular, like, what does the baby know? Is the baby like smart? does it have a theory of the vagina or is it just complete tabula rasa that, you know, so the stuff like this, that's a, yeah, it's a great chapter. You want to do the next part, Emma? I'm bad. I'm passing. Okay. You want me to,
I mean, the next part has an essay by Gila Ashter, critiquing Means No Future. It has one by Natasha Hurley, which is on La Planche and enigmatic signifiers. And that was another kind of vector in the book, is there were a number of essays that worked with La Planche and his particular sort of ideas about temporality. And then Kenneth Kidd, who was talking about the philosophy of children movement in the United States and the extent to which that can be sort of considered a queer institution.
I mean, I think that part grew out of this question around how children are used politically, the figure of the child specifically, not children actually, but the child with a capital C, and how both queers and for like normative ends, but also for like a queer future, and in the name of which, you know, children are kind of, the child is a kind of terrain. It's both a screen into which hopes and futures are projected, and it's also, you know, as a way of denying for some death and sex. So it functions in various ways, this figure.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of them were also, I mean, and this seems to me to be an interesting line of thought that's been developing since like Edelman was published, and is something that someone like Maggie Nelson I think, really promotes, which is to kind of push back also against this notion that the child must needs be this kind of representative of heteronormative futurity that we have to reject for that reason. You know, there, I think there was a way in which a number of essays in the book were sort of asking the question, like, how can we take the child, how can we confront the child as itself a queer subject without rejecting the figural child as Edelman, you know, importantly and for, you know, important political reasons, but as he demands, but is there another kind of dialectical turn that we can take on that theory and return to the child, having come to that place in theory, but return to the child? And something that I was sort of asking about, and this Maggie Nelson does the same too in The Argonauts, is how can we confront also the idea of pregnancy or having a baby or a biological mother, and not sort of necessarily reject that those figures either under under a heteronormative aegis. So I think there was a way in which, like, and in which some of the essays were coming out from Edelman and making a critique that was absolutely dependent on his theory, but trying to come to a new place with it.
I'd be really interested in reading Gayla's paper. I'm actually in an editor's meeting tomorrow. I'm editing a book on queer psychoanalysis, and Gayla Esther also contributed an essay to that chapter. So I'm really interested in reading her piece on the Edelman. So interesting.
I think Edelman, you know, Edelman's original kind of like, we're all using the child for this normative, you know, to basically, what is it, exclude the queer people from the social order. It could use a rereading now that the trans child is at the center of so much debate. And transness, you know, in quotes, in scare quotes, is being kind of, the child is burdened with having to be this figure that is then going to, on both sides of the debate, you know, is being utilized. So we didn't push it far enough in this volume because it, you know, it was a slightly different time. And, but I think this is the beginning of a new era, as it were.
Yep.
And then the last part is on animation. And basically looks at animation, and my essay is in there, and an animator, Clement Goldberg. We have a kind of graphic essay using his stills from one of his animated films. So it just sort of points to the ways in which children's culture can be quite queer, and that animation is a kind of queer art because it offers a kind of plasticity, and you can have representation. It really plays with gender and with time and with you know, representational schema. It can be used for, of course, conservative ends like some of the Disney stuff of yesteryear, or it can be Pixar and, you know, various claymation. Really, it could also be a kind of radical art form that pushes these boundaries of what time, gender, sex, etc. And of all places, it's in animation, which is supposedly children's art. Or for children, rather.
Yeah, how did you get interested in that in the first place, Anna?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, so in the late Soviet period, I'm a child of that era. I was born in the Soviet Union and immigrated when I was 6 years old in the late 70s. And I still have all of these records, and I grew up with these animated films. In the Soviet Union, one has to understand the culture is very coherent and cohesive. Like, is everybody watches these animated films. Everybody is it, you know, it kind of seeps into you. Whereas I guess in the United States, there are these, I guess we have this too, right? Like there are these films that everybody grew up with. But I think in the Soviet period, they were fewer. And so they were popular culture, animation, children's culture was popular culture. Also, it was quite subversive. It was the place where people went in this Aesopian way to challenge the regime. It also, the animators were all queer, or a lot of them were. So I learned from interviews. This is where people went where, you know, the normal channels, the regular so-called, you know, mainstream channels were denied them. And so they went to animation and made their home there. So there is some real, the messages aren't just me like overreading or reading against the grain. Sometimes I'm reading with the grain, and this is what this was a shock to me. So I'm like, I have to write about this. This is so
fascinating. It's amazing. And people always find a way. I love that, you know?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
That's wonderful. And what are you working on now? What about you, Emma?
I'm working sort of early-ish or midway in the process of a book manuscript that is on, it's called Feminine Professions. It's a play on impossible professions. And it's sort of primarily on psychoanalysis and education, but I'm also thinking a good deal about literature, which I always am, since I'm a literature professor as well. And then I'm also, the other vector that I'm thinking about is auto theory, as it's emerged in the last decade or so. And I'm trying to, how can I describe what I'm doing? The reason I'm calling it feminine professions is something at the sort of center of it is I was very influenced by, I've been very influenced by Shoshana Fellman, who I actually studied with decades ago and have been reading for a very long time, and who is, you know, one of the best sort of purveyors of psychoanalysis and literature. And she has this concept of what she calls feminine resistance, which she develops primarily in a reading of Freud's Irma Dream as the sort of birthplace of psychoanalysis. And so she's trying to say something about feminine resistance as a kind of ethical principle in psychoanalysis, but also as a part of a reading practice, and a way of reading literarily that is then sort of inherently connected with psychoanalytic listening. And she connects this to femininity in a way that's not totally elaborated, but I always found extremely interesting. And so something that I'm trying to do throughout the book is to underline something of what I'm identifying as the kind of feminine procedure as a kind of reading practice in these kind of four fields: psychoanalysis, education, literature, and auto theory. And part of what I'm kind of aiming at is that contemporary culture at the moment really needs something of the feminine. And that there's a way of looking at these four fields and the way that they purvey something of this, of precisely this practice that I think we're particularly in need of as a culture at the moment. So that's the first time I've given the spiel.
Love it.
Actually, it may be the first time ever I've given the spiel, so maybe I'll listen back and see if it makes any sense.
What did I say?
You see what Vanessa, what service she's providing. Really drawing us out here.
That's good. That's psychoanalysis at its best. Understand what you're saying through saying it.
Right.
And I just realized, I know this seems obvious now that I've realized it as usual, but I just realized like a week ago, I'm like, I totally brought Umbahagen with me by making this podcast because I started it in January 2018. I left New York in August of 2017. And I was just in this like interim period where I couldn't move to Sweden yet because I didn't have my residency, but I'd already like closed my practice and left my apartment in New York. So it was like floating in between like Miami, where I'm from, and and Sweden. And I just like was like, what do I do? I'm so used to having a full private practice and doing all these Umhangen events with you all and everyone. And now I'm just like at my mom's house in her spare room. Like, what happened to my life? And I just like had the idea like, oh, I could start a podcast and start interviewing these like friends and stuff. And then I realized like, oh, we used to do these events like every week. And this is how I've kind of continued it and like been able to keep community. Absolutely. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we wrap up?
I don't know. I think I'm good. What about you, Em?
We'll just have to come up with our next project, I guess. This has been gestating for so long between the two of us, and so much happened. And there was the pandemic, and a lot happened between its conception and when it came out that I don't know. I feel like I'm still kind of mourning it a little bit.
And it took 9 years altogether since the conference. So 9 years, 9 months. There's something about
there you go.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to see, like, Emma, how your projects are unfolding from, like, your focus on writing and literature. It's going to be interesting to see, like, as time goes on and you have more and more projects unfold, like this apres-coup movement of how your different projects folded into one another, you know, and influenced your kind of development. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a really nice way of thinking about it. It also like, it's helpful because it makes me feel like I will actually complete some of these projects since you seem to be assuming that I will. So.
And then you'll come on the podcast and talk about them. Yeah, you will. And I want to hear about your book too, Anna, when you're ready. We can talk about our memoir books.
In a way it also builds on stuff in this volume. So it has strands, definitely.
And I should also tell you remember the Rendering Unconscious book that we put together? So long ago, I guess 5 years ago now. I just edited like a new updated version with a new intro and like added some new pieces. And it's actually so big that now we've split it into two volumes. So that will be published soon, like in, I think, about 6 weeks. And that will be on Amazon and available on all the online retailers and everything. Because my husband has a different distribution system now for his publishing company. So you don't have to order it from Sweden anymore.
And they're transcribed, all the interviews are transcribed?
That's going to be our next project, though.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a Rendering Unconscious book, but that Emma's in. Emma has two pieces in it, one in each volume. I made sure there's one in each volume. And then that's the next thing I'm going to do is start looking at all of the different talks in interviews and like thinking about them by topic, like psychoanalysis and technology or psychoanalysis and social justice, things like this, and then making edited collections of like the interviews so that people can read them too, for people who like books.
It's wonderful that that volume was published when my younger son was just learning to read, and it's a very, very thick book, so it's sort of prominent on my shelf. And he thought that the title was Remembering Unicorns. Aww. So that's how we refer to the book. And to the podcast. You can take it if you want. You could change the title to Remembering Unicorns if you want.
Remembering Unicorns. I'm going to have to weave that in somehow. Well, it was so nice to get to catch up with you both.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, Vanessa.
And anytime you want to come back, just shoot me an email.
We will.
And I'll keep you posted on the May New York trip.
Yes, please. Yeah, and on the conference too.
I will.
You know. Awesome.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Rendering Unconscious. You've just heard a discussion with Doctors Emma Lieber and Anna Fijon. They discussed their new book, The Queerness of Childhood, Essays from the Other Side of the Looking Glass, which you can find a link to in the show notes for this episode, as well as at renderingunconscious.org. Be sure to listen to previous episodes with Emma Lieber, Rendering Unconscious episode number 29, and number 119, which was a book launch for her book, The Writing Cure. We also mentioned the coming together of the two new volumes of Rendering Unconscious, the book, which you can find at Amazon and other online retailers. And the conference we mentioned at the end of this episode is called Ronk Horror. It's a conference about the theories of Otto Ronk, going to be held at Columbia University, May 8th through the 10th. I will be flying into New York for this conference, and it is a conference that is free and open to the public. As soon as the link to register comes up online, I will share it in the show notes for this episode. I also have an episode coming up with conference organizer Nathan Gorlick, and I will also publish the link to register in his episode as well. I look forward to seeing you all there. While I'm in New York, I will also be having an event at Quimby's Bookstore on Saturday, May 11th in Brooklyn with my other author friends, Jason Hoff and Advat, two other Trapar authors. I will be launching my novel, Things Happen. Jason Hoff will be launching his book, Can I See Your Niche? Cut-ups and Collages. And Advat will be launching his book, A Spiral of Objects, which is a wonderfully wild, weird read. I cannot recommend that book enough. It's one of my favorite books of all time, and definitely favorite book of 2023. So join us at Quimby's on May 11th and at Columbia University, May 8th through 10th for the conference Ronk Horror. And be sure to pick up the two new volumes of Rendering Unconscious, the book, Rendering Unconscious, Psychoanalytic Perspectives, Politics, and Poetry. I hope you enjoy them. As always, huge thanks to Carl Abrahamson for providing the intro and outro music for Rendering Unconscious podcast. You can sign up for his new Substack, thefenriswolf.substack.com, and check out his website, carlabrahamson.com. That's Carl with a C and Abrahamson with two S's. He posts everything he's up to there. I also have a Substack, renderingunconscious.substack.com, specifically focused on the podcast, as is my Patreon, patreon.com/renderingunconscious. And then I have a Substack for all of Carl and my happenings together, vanessa23carl.substack.com, and our Patreon, where we post exclusive content every week on Mondays. That's patreon.com/Vanessa23Carl. Huge thanks to everyone in our community. Your support is greatly appreciated. I really love the Discord that we have going. It's so nice to be able to chat with people on an ongoing basis and to see everyone chatting and inspiring each other. It's really, really wonderful. And you can join our Discord if you join either Patreon, the Rendering Unconscious, or my Patreon with Carl. So join us and I'll see you there. As mentioned in previous episodes, Rendering Unconscious was awarded the 2023 Gradiva Award for Digital Media. Huge, huge, huge thanks to the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis for this honor, as well as to all the guests of Rendering Unconscious, the fans, the listeners, and our Patreon community. I couldn't do it without you, so thank you. And now the song, Diana's Horns, from the album The Experience for the Weird, a collaboration I did with Pete Murphy, available at petemurphy.bandcamp.com. You can also find our music at Spotify and other streaming services. Enjoy. I listen to her, and I can see Diana's horns. Around her orb, we see sky and sea. She isn't lying. I try to follow her. Perhaps, after all, the Burning Man, her visibility and grace for navigation, hunting, she command of duty to lend yourself. Visibility and grace for navigation. Duty to lend yourself. Your hands are not your own, nor are your breasts, nor most especially any of your bodily orifices. Feel me? No one can. A woman sang, with which we may explore or penetrate at will. You will remember, though, was this what she had meant by so? It would be great to see her in the flesh. Like psychic aspect of one's actions and relations, those attempted through the conscious correction of the ego's course are attempts of the will.